The Shadow and the Flash by Jack London. Published by Macmillan Education, a division of Macmillan Publishers Limited. Copyright Macmillan Publishers Limited, 2011. Part 4. A few weeks later, I went hunting with Paul. He had been promising me for some time that I should have the pleasure of shooting over a wonderful dog. The most wonderful dog, in fact, that ever man shot over, so he averred, and continued to aver till my curiosity was aroused. But on the morning in question I was disappointed, for there was no dog in evidence.
"Don't see him about,"
Paul remarked unconcernedly, and we set off across the fields. I could not imagine, at the time, what was ailing me, but I had a feeling of some impending and deadly illness. My nerves were all awry, and, from the astounding tricks they played me, my senses seemed to have run riot. Strange sounds disturbed me. At times, I heard the swish-swish of grass being shoved aside, and once the patter of feet across a patch of stony ground.
"Did you hear anything, Paul?" I asked once.
But he shook his head and thrust his feet steadily forward. While climbing a fence, I heard the low, eager whine of a dog, apparently from within a couple of feet of me. But on looking about me, I saw nothing. I dropped to the ground, limp and trembling.
"Paul," I said, "we had better return to the house. I'm afraid I am going to be sick."
"Nonsense, old man," he answered. "The sunshine has gone to your head like wine. You'll be all right. It's famous weather."
But, passing along a narrow path through a clump of cottonwoods, some object brushed against my legs, and I stumbled and nearly fell. I looked with sudden anxiety at Paul.
"What's the matter?" he asked. "Tripping over your own feet?"
I kept my tongue between my teeth and plodded on, though sore perplexed and thoroughly satisfied that some acute and mysterious malady had attacked my nerves. So far, my eyes had escaped. But when we got to the open fields again, even my vision went back on me. Strange flashes of vari-colored rainbow light began to appear and disappear on the path before me. Still, I managed to keep myself in hand till the vari-colored lights persisted for a space of fully 20 seconds, dancing and flashing in continuous play. Then I sat down, weak and shaky.
"It's all up with me," I gasped, covering my eyes with my hands. "It has attacked my eyes. Paul, take me home."
But Paul laughed long and loud.
"What did I tell you? The most wonderful dog, eh? Well, what do you think?"
He turned partly from me and began to whistle. I heard the patter of feet, the panting of a heated animal, and the unmistakable yelp of a dog. Then Paul stooped down and apparently fondled the empty air.
"Here, give me your fist."
And he rubbed my hand over the cold nose and jowls of a dog. A dog it certainly was, with the shape and the smooth short coat of a pointer. Suffice to say, I speedily recovered my spirits and control. Paul put a collar about the animal's neck and tied his handkerchief to its tail, and then was vouchsafed us the remarkable sight of an empty collar and a waving handkerchief cavorting over the fields. It was something to see that collar and handkerchief pin a bevy of quail in a clump of locusts and remain rigid and immovable till we had flushed the birds. Now and again, the dog emitted the vari-colored light flashes I have mentioned. The one thing, Paul explained, which he had not anticipated, and which he doubted could be overcome.
"They're a large family," he said. "These sun dogs, wind dogs, rainbows, halos, and parhelia. They are produced by refraction of light from mineral and ice crystals, from mist, rain, spray, and no end of things. And I am afraid they are the penalty I must pay for transparency. I escaped Lloyd's shadow, only to fetch up against the Rainbow Flash.
A couple of days later, before the entrance to Paul's laboratory, I encountered a terrible stench. So overpowering was it that it was easy to discover the source. A mass of putrescent matter on the doorstep, which in general outlines resembled a dog. Paul was startled when he investigated my find. It was his invisible dog, or rather, what had been his invisible dog, for it was now plainly visible. It had been playing about but a few minutes before in all health and strength. Closer examination revealed that the skull had been crushed by some heavy blow. While it was strange that the animal should have been killed, the inexplicable thing was that it should so quickly decay.
"The reagents I injected into his system were harmless," Paul explained. "Yet they were powerful, and it appears that when death comes, they force practically instantaneous disintegration. Remarkable. Most remarkable. Well, the only thing is not to die. They do not harm so long as one lives. But I do wonder who smashed in that dog's head."
Light, however, was thrown upon this when a frightened housemaid brought the news that Gaffer Bedshaw had that very morning, not more than an hour back, gone violently insane and was strapped down at home in the Huntsman's Lodge, where he raved of a battle with a ferocious and gigantic beast that he had encountered in the Titchlorn pasture. He claimed that the thing, whatever it was invisible, that with his own eyes he had seen that it was invisible, wherefore his tearful wife and daughters shook their heads, and wherefore he but waxed the more violent, and the gardener and the coachman tightened the straps by another hole. Nor, while Paul Titchlorn was thus successfully mastering the problem of invisibility, was Lloyd Inwood a whit behind. I went over in answer to a message of his to come and see how he was getting on. Now, his laboratory occupied an isolated situation in the midst of his vast grounds. It was built in a pleasant little glade, surrounded on all sides by a dense forest growth, and was to be gained by way of a winding and erratic path. But I have traveled that path so often as to know every foot of it, and conceive my surprise when I came upon the glade and found no laboratory. The quaint shed structure with its red sandstone chimney was not, nor did it look as if it ever had been. There were no signs of ruin, no debris, nothing. I started to walk across what had once been its site. "This," I said to myself, "should be where the step went up to the door." Barely were the words out of my mouth when I stubbed my toe on some obstacle, pitched forward, and butted my head into something that felt very much like a door. I reached out my hand. It was a door. I found the knob and turned it. And at once, as the door swung inward on its hinges, the whole interior of the laboratory impinged upon my vision. Greeting Lloyd, I closed the door and backed up the path a few paces. I could see nothing of the building. Returning and opening the door, at once all the furniture and every detail of the interior were visible. It was indeed startling. The sudden transition from void to light and form and color.
"What do you think of it, eh?" Lloyd asked, wringing my hand. "I slapped a couple of coats of absolute black on the outside yesterday afternoon to see how it worked. How's your head? You bumped it pretty solidly, I imagine." "Never mind that," he interrupted my congratulations. "I've something better for you to do.